Hi, everybody. I'm Gary. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey.
And I also happen to be Nick's sponsor, which is why I'm up here in the first place. But before I get started, I'd like you to do me a favor. And that is, anybody that has taken meetings into either jails or prisons, will you please stand up? Yeah. Yes, I consider this to be a privilege to be up here, and this is actually a celebration for anybody that takes meetings into such places as prisons and jails. In terms of it, I started at the Gwinnett County Detention Center in 2002, and that's what I've been doing that for 23 years. In 2014, this guy shows up, and as best as I can tell, he was bulletproof. He wouldn't stop talking, he wasn't disciplined, he was just a pain in the ass, and I basically wanted to kick him out of the meeting we were in. Okay, and but we were doing fourth and fifth steps at that time, and it's a little bit of a different experience when you're doing a fourth and fifth step in a linoleum hall with surrounded by concrete. You've got 45 minutes, that's all you've got. And he's filled out his sheets in code. That's because there's no privacy in jails, and that's what we instructed people to do. And so we only had 45 minutes, and you have to go for the gusto when you only have a 45-minute fourth step, and that's precisely what Nick did. But then what would happen, he would just disappear. And in August of 2015, I'm at my home group, NABA, with my sponsor, and a lady who was the secretary there, she comes down. I have a letter that is addressed to Gary at NABA. You see, at the Gwinnett County Detention Center, you're not allowed to use last name, so I didn't know his last name, he didn't know mine. But anyway, I got this letter, which I'd like to read to you. Dear Gary, hey, my friend, I'm not sure where to send this letter, but I remember you talking about NABA and the Gwinnett Room, so I'm sending it to NABA. I hope you remember me, too. I'm the guy who asked you to do my step four in the Gwinnett County Jail about a year ago, and my dad recently passed away. Anyway, I would still like you to sponsor me when I get out. That's neither here nor there right now. I'm writing because I want to say thanks, man, for bringing AA meetings into the county jail. For me, those meetings were the only hope I got. They helped me realize that I'm an alcoholic, and I'm not the only one, that even though I felt like the only one for many years. I'm also sure that I cannot deal with my disease all by myself. I mean, I don't think I'm alone. Sure, I cannot deal with my, either when I say self-examination sucks, and the idea of going around one day and righting all the wrongs I've caused is the last thing I have on my mind that I think that sounds like fun. But I'm willing to do it if it means having what you guys have. And I still have the conviction that I'm willing to do whatever it takes. This place is okay. They keep me busy, that's for sure. There's no meeting down here. I mean, not AA nor NA. But they have their own meetings in a dorm with 48 other men, and maybe 8 out of 10 actually want to be sober. I have no problem with that personally, but I feel my serenity is so new and so fragile that I'll lose it altogether if I begin to worry about what the next man is doing. Can you dig it? As so far as I've learned to pray a lot. I have 16 months right now from all mind and mood altering chemicals. I want the spiritual experiences that you all talk about so that I am writing to do this sober. Sometimes I feel like I'll lose my mind, but then I pray and ask God to help me get over myself. Anyway, I could really use some support or anything. I miss the meetings and the feeling that comes. I just like you to say you had nowhere else to go when you got to AA, and that's where I am. Nobody wants me but the program. I believe you all when you say I don't ever have to use again, and I don't have to take anything to be okay. I'm still crazy as shit, excuse me, most of the time. But even that, I'm not as crazy as I was this time last year, so I count that as progress. So if you just got a minute to write me here, I'll be coming home. I have no home. Say I will find a halfway house, but my release date is April 14th, 2016. Be good, Gary. And I send with love. As it so turns out, he did get out in April. And he got a job right off the bat, but it was one of that workout joints with all the hard body females. He started playing the field. And I told him, Nick, you can't do this. She's going to bring out something to enhance your experience, and you're going to go back out. And so he did, by August, he had about a two-week period. I didn't hear anything from him. And he called me up. I screwed up. Was that a surprise? Okay. But anyway, his sobriety date turns out to be September 5th of 2016. He did have to go up but downstate for another 2 years. But he got out, and I will tell you, for anybody that wants to do the fourth and fifth step workshop tomorrow, he got out on October 2nd of 2018, and he was 8 days later, he was in the fourth and fifth step workshop. So the example here, as far as I'm concerned, if somebody is new, somebody is out of prison, and you want to change, this is where you can start. You have an example here of someone who was arrested 22 times in Gwinnett County alone. That's no fish story. You can look at his name that happens to be on the program. Go to the Gwinnett County Sheriff's Office, and you'll find him there. Okay? And so with that in mind, we have a remarkable opportunity to watch how he's changed since then. And with that, I am so proud to introduce you to Nick. Come on, Nick. Rock 80. Man, thank you, Gary. My name is Nick Staples. I'm an alcoholic. Amen. By the grace of a God that I really, really don't understand, I have been clean and sober from all mood and mind altering substances since September 5th, 2016. And had the same sponsor for two more years over that. I consider him the sponsor. You're not really allowed to sponsor in jail, but man, I remember writing that letter, and I really appreciate that. And this rock, this place here, is what's a huge part of the reason why I could work a fifth step and a fourth step, is why I could open up and become, thanks, Alan, why I could open up and why I could do the things that we need to do in recovery. But I'm up here to talk about my favorite subject, me. So let's do this with, I like to start things like this, really anything, with a prayer. And one of my favorite prayers, I'll just say that. God, I offer myself to you, to build with me and do with me as you will. Remove me from the bondage of self, so that I may better do thy will. Relieve me of my difficulties, so that victory over them may bear witness to those who I would help with thy love, thy will, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. That's a powerful prayer. Very, very powerful prayer. But I got a little bit of an outline because I need a little bit of order. I got a few brain cells up here still kicking, and they need order, and I need order. So I'm an alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic for one reason. It was very complicated at first, but it's just simple now. I no matter how bad I want that first drink, I want that second drink a whole lot more. And once I take that first drink, nothing else really matters. I'm going to take a second, and a third, and a fourth. And I don't really have the capability of stopping. I'm going to be stopped. But I do know how to stop. Never really punched a cop in the face, but I've thought about it. They usually get to me first, and so usually the law enforcement stops me before I can really take it to the grave. But then there's this other part of me that makes me an alcoholic, and there's this other part of me that something in me that will always taking the first drink or drug or anything make sense. It's just always going to make sense to me. And I'm the guy who uses or who drinks no matter what. You know, I try to not drink. I try to not use, but I'm going to use no matter what. My history proves that. But I was born in 86. That's a long time ago for some of y'all, not so long for some of the others. But I was born in 86 to a wonderful mother. She was alcoholic herself, and she was great half the week, and then the weekend would come, and she was different. And to me, it was the only normal life that I had. I'm pretty sure I had a pretty average normal childhood. I had Christmases. I had, you know, parents that loved me. I didn't really have anything, you know, incredibly crazy. Nothing to really cause me to live the way I ended up living later on in life. I just, you know, had parents. My parents, they found a way to love me. They found a way to support me. Mom would kind of go off the deep end, and then she would come back, and that was my childhood experience. I don't remember much from it, but I do know that by the time I was in third grade, I had the guidance counselor following me around. Hey, are you okay? Is everything all right? Where are these bruises from? Da, 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 da. At some point in time, my stepdad tried to adopt me, and then I found out that he wasn't really my dad, and I had a real dad, and he wanted to meet me, and so I met my other parents, and that was kind of a fiasco that lasted for a couple of years, and I'm sure that caused some sort of trauma. But for me, I'm very sensitive, you know, and from my perspective, everything's happening to me. And I'm kind of the center of the universe. And it didn't really matter what anybody said or did. It really is my perspective. And I from my vantage point, I am the center of the universe. I happen, and then everything else is happening. And that's kind of like the selfishness and self-centeredness that I think that we do. But I think about me a lot. You know, I don't know if that's normal. I don't know if you guys relate to that. To a fault, really. They call it a disease, I guess. And the thing that I know is that when I started realizing that other people were here when I was old enough to do that, I looked out and I realized I'm not the same as everybody else out there. I don't feel the same as you look. I don't feel the same as the way the other boys look. I'm just not, you know? And so I started trying to do things to match up, and I never really could feel the way you looked. And I don't think the problem was I was different. The problem was is my perspective. I was judging my insides with your outsides. And I was really, really focused on the way I feel. And my mom was really focused on the way she felt. And that's what I knew. And so I look at my mother. I mean, she became, you know, alcoholism is a sick thing. The sickness hurts other people. And I was hurt. I was damaged growing up. Began having some issues in school. I would go to school and I just couldn't handle it. And I found out that if I was sick enough and fought hard enough, I wouldn't have to go into school. So I started missing school in third and fourth grade. Oh man, third, fourth, fifth grade, just school, normal kid stuff. I found my way into the sixth grade, and you know, by this time I was listening to rap music and things like that. And you know, I had some issues that happened. And you know, I want to give a shout out to Steve Orr and you know, his sex and sobriety workshop, because that's what opened me up to this program. That's what really changed me. And it was because when I was 9 or 10 years old, there was another boy in the neighborhood, and he started molesting me, and it continued on for quite some time. That was something I was never going to tell anybody ever in my entire life. That was the one thing that was going to keep me separated from you and everybody else. And now I can stand up here and I can tell you guys that, and nothing touches me. It doesn't. I don't feel a thing, because that is the one thing that was going to keep me away from Alcoholics Anonymous. That was the one thing that was going to keep me from working the 12 steps and keep me disconnected. And that's the one thing that I had to share when I did that. And I came to this workshop and I shared that in that place. So God bless that man for that workshop, and God bless that workshop. But going on, there was that was going on and caused a little bit of confusion. But going into sixth grade, I got into a fight, and the fight, you know, a kid hit me, I hit him. I don't really know how it started, but I was terrified, and I got into a fight. I won the fight, and the parents said there had to be action, and the action was that I go to YDC or get criminally charged with beating somebody up or whatever. And the principal came to me. She said, "Hey, look, you know how that guidance counselor comes and talks to you and meets you in the hallway? That's not an accident. We've been watching you. We've got a file on you, everything. All you got to do is say that you've been on something, marijuana, alcohol, you were on something, and then we can put you in somewhere like Charter Peachford in Atlanta, and you can get out of YDC. And I said, okay, let's do that. So we concocted this lie. I'd never seen anything, but for the first time in my life, before I'd ever seen or touched a drink, alcohol and drugs became a solution for me and did for me what I couldn't do for myself. Kept me out of YDC. So instead of going there, I went to Charter Peachford and, you know, started maintaining this lie. And my mom was just happy as she could be because she had found the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and her solution was to just put me in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know how early recovery is. Like, you know, we're alcoholic. Everybody's an alcoholic. Everybody needs the program. Everybody needs the steps. So, you know, my son's going to work the steps. I'm going to work the steps. And, yeah, that's the way it is. And so she meant well. She really did. But I ended up in this, you know, treatment, and they put me into another place. It's a place called Atlanta Insight. And Atlanta Insight was a whole lot of fun because they convinced my parents that I should start smoking and drop out of school, and I could do their program, and everything would be fine if they just paid them enough money. And, you know, I had a blast, man. I loved it. So I didn't have to go to school. So from age 12 to age 15, I was in this place, and I was upholding this lie. And, you know, I'd never seen anything. I did end up meeting some guys, and they introduced me to alcohol. The first time I ever drank, I got incredibly blitzed. You know, we went to go find some cocaine, but cocaine's hard to find when you're 12 years old. So we found something called Special K, which was a little bit different than what we expected. And, you know, so alcohol, Special K, and a couple other things. And I just kind of went down to the dumps, and I didn't really like that. But, you know, another trip to Charter Peachford, back, everything's good. Cool. So it's been a couple of years, didn't touch anything. And then I left. I turned the age of 15, and, you know, I got tired of that place and decided that I wanted to leave, and I left. And a couple of my friends came over. As a matter of fact, one of my Ebbies in this program sitting in this room tonight came over, and they said, "Hey, man, you want to try some meth?" I was like, "Yes. Yes, I do." Didn't no idea what it was, but you know why I said yes? I said yes because I wanted to be a part of what these guys were doing. I just wanted to be a part of something, and I wanted this to be like that. I wanted to be a part of whatever they were doing. And, you know, I took one line, burned like crap, didn't feel a thing, took a second one, and I discovered the meaning of the universe, man. And we had a conversation that will blow your freaking mind. And then I started coming down. And I started coming down, and I said, "Hey, what do I do about this?" I said, "Go up to the store, get you a 40-ounce bottle or whatever you can get," because I had a fake ID. I don't know how I had a fake ID, but I did. And it said I was 21, and I found a store that would take it, and I bought a 40-ounce, and I drank it. And all of that weird, crazy, coming down stuff just kind of evened out, man. Just evened me out. And I drank that and went to sleep, and I said, "Whew, whatever that was, I'm going to do it again. I'm going to do that again." And I decided that I'm going to do that stuff again, man. And that, you know, that became a part of it. And you know, alcohol wasn't a problem. Not at all, man. Alcohol was the best solution that I had ever found to fix whatever the hell I had going on. And I discovered that day. I didn't materialize it. It wasn't like, "Oh, this is a solution." It just worked, man. It was a good fit. You know, houses didn't burn down. I didn't go to prison. Nobody found out. Everything was fine. It took just a little tiny amount to achieve so much in my life. And I was comfortable with who I was around. I was comfortable with who I was with. And I could be a part of these things. And I found something that makes me like you. And I knew it. And I knew that I was going to hold on to that thing and not let go. And that's just the way I am. So we continued on. And it was a party. And we had fun. And I decided, you know, things. It started taking a little bit more and more from the age of 15. I'm telling you, man, 15 years old, I held off. I really did. I held off for as long as I possibly could. You know, 15 is a good ripe age for someone like me with the stuff that goes on in here before I actually found a solution in drugs and alcohol. But I started drinking, started using. I would usually start my day out with a drink, get good and wasted, and do something that made me go up. And, you know, I have fun decoding, or not decoding, but like counting the carpet fibers. I mean, that's a great time for me. And then I'd drink to come down, and I just continue to drink. And, you know, when I drank, I wasn't scared. When I was drunk, I fit in. I started, you know, I remember I went to a job interview, and I went to a job interview half lit, and I was like, "There's no way I'm getting this thing," but I killed the interview and I got the job. I got the job drunk. I mean, this thing, alcohol was the key, man. It fit. And it fit in ways a lot more than just whatever they said it was. Because my mom, if you would have listened to her tell her experience, alcohol will put you down in the dumps. It'll take you, it wasn't happening to me, man. Like, whatever they told me about drinking and my issues, then they were wrong. They were wrong because my experience said something different. Now, started getting a little bit more criminal stuff. You know, I started to need a little bit more and more money. So I started, you know, learning. I started how to use some digital scales. Figured out how to do math. Figured out math was a good skill set for me because, you know, when I had a reason to use math, I was really good at it. So I learned fractions. and that helped me get my GED in prison later. But you know, at the end of the day, I was having a lot of fun, man. I had people, and it was part of a scene, and I had something I'd never had before. But again, I said it took more and more, achieved less and less. The first time I used drugs intravenously, I was 17 years old, and pretty much everybody else was doing it, and it just took off from there. That became the new love of my life. And my first arrest was shortly after for shoplifting, and I don't really remember what that was, but I remember standing in jail, and the guy had been there before, and I'm like, this guy named Scully, and Scully had been there before, and he's like, man, they're going to give you eggs, and you get cigarettes, da 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 da. And that was my first arrest, and I was scared, I was terrified, and I had a dad who would bond me out a lot, and he would bond me out and take me home. And shortly after, my mother got sick. My mom got sick, and she got sick with cancer. She had been sick with cancer this whole time, as a matter of fact, and I didn't give a shit. I really didn't. Not that I don't care about my mom, it's that I didn't have the capacity to care about anything other than myself. And she died one of the times I was in jail. My dad came, and he said, hey, your mother passed from cancer. And I went back to my cell, and I cried. He said, I'm going to bond you out. We're going to take you to the funeral. We're going to send you out to a halfway house in Gainesville, Georgia, and then I'm done with you. Mind you, this is my stepdad. He has no reason to have any affiliation with me at all, but at this time he still is. And he took me out to the halfway house, and I said, okay, I'm done. I'm done with this life. I'm done with these things. I've had enough. I go out to this halfway house, and very, very soon, I got out, went to my mom's funeral, went to this halfway house. I was going to change my life, and I really, really was going to stay sober. I was about 19 years old for the rest of my life. And really quickly, like, it went from, I'm going to stay sober, I'll do whatever it takes, to, man, these people aren't treating me right. These people don't appreciate everything I do. You know, my roommate snores, man. And really what was going on was I was having this attack of this restlessness, this irritability, this discontentment, that this stuff, this thing inside me was getting tighter and tighter. I heard it described one time as a spring in his gut, and it gets tighter and tighter, and I'm like, that's what it is for me. The farther away I got from a drink, the worse it got, because there was nothing to keep me away from me. There was no lubricant from the world, and I can't really take you guys for very long. I can't take the world, I can't take traffic, I can't take this. It's just too much, too bright. It's just too intense. You guys are too intense, especially people. And I decided that I was just going to go out. And so I left and went about another halfway house, and just the type of chaos that comes up with that. And, I left and went to another halfway house, but in the in-between, there was a hotel, and that's where I smoked crack for the first time. So that was fun. Because they didn't have any meth in Gainesville at the time. So I just got a bottle of liquor and, had fun with that. But that type of cycle went on for another 8 years, I would say. I couldn't not use. I couldn't not drink. It got to the point where I had to have something in me just to get out of the bed. I don't really remember when it happened, but at some point in time, I joined a gang because those guys had power and those guys had dope, and I thought I would be like those guys. And I turned around, and all of a sudden, I had real enemies. Talk about fear. I had a lot of fear before that. Now I have real fucking fear. Excuse me. Real fear. And I was doing things that I thought I'd never do. These guys would hire me out. I remember it's like an interview with this guy. He said, okay, what can you do for me? You can do these drugs. And I said, no, I'll do them all. I know you guys. And he said, okay, well, you're going to do collections for me. So that's what I started doing. That was the best job I could find at the time. So they would come and they would say, hey, go kick this door in, scare this guy, get the money, bring it back to us. And I started doing that. And I don't know, I had that job for a couple of months until one day I kicked in a door, went in there, and I slapped the guy around a little bit, came out, and there were cops everywhere. They just came out of nowhere. But here's the funny thing is, despite all of that happened, I had two feelings. One, I felt alive. Two, I felt like it was over. It was over. When I got on my knees and those dogs were barking, I just, oh, it's over. But they still gave me a bond. He still gave me a bond, and my dad still bonded me out. So I got bonded out from that, got some more felonies, and finally I wasn't getting out. And the last time, I knew I was in trouble, I knew I was running hard. I called a buddy of mine in Mexico City, and I said, "Hey, buddy, I'm coming to Mexico City, and we're going to live this thing out, man. You're going to teach me the ways." He's like, "All right, don't bring that stuff here, because that stuff here is like really a death sentence." So I bought a bunch of pills, and I made it from Buford Highway all the way to about Satellite till I don't remember anything, and I woke up in the jail. I woke up in the jail, non-responsive, and you know, I just, that's my going on the run story, and I showed up to the jail, and they said I wasn't breathing, and then they put me in the ambulance, and I remember one thing. I remember being in the hospital at that time, and I remember, you know, going back to jail, and I didn't know why I was there. No one would tell me why I was there. They had me in a weird spot of the jail that, like, I'd never been before, and I looked in the mirror, and I looked like this shriveled old man. It wasn't the mirror. They'd have mirrors where I was, but I saw the reflection in, like, the way the light was shining, and I looked like this shriveled old man. And it had been a couple weeks, and they said, "Hey, you know what day it is?" And I said, "Yeah, it's, like, such and such a day." I was like, "Oh, yeah, it was actually 2 weeks after that. You've been out for a while." And I'm like, "Okay, cool." So there I am in jail for the last time. Nobody would tell me why I was there. And I asked for a book. I wanted a book. And they brought me two books. I want a Bible. They want to bring me a Bible. I don't know why. They didn't have a Bible. It's the first time they didn't have a Bible. But they brought me two books. They brought me a Star Trek book. And they brought me another book called A Better Way. And it was a guy that had been in prison. And he had got sober in prison. And this was his story. And I couldn't read the Star Trek book. I couldn't focus on that. I couldn't focus on anything. God, by the grace of God, I was able to focus on this guy's book. But I read the book, man. There's so many. There were enough similarities in this guy's story and the way he felt and what he did. And he said, "If you want what I have, you'll get on your knees and you'll pray and you'll give yourself to God." And I did that. I got on my knees. I prayed and I asked God to take this, whatever it was. And I guess he did. Two things happened. I wanted to go to an AA meeting, and I wanted to read spiritual things. I just got this hunger for spiritual stuff, I guess you could say. But I was absolutely crazy, absolutely miserable, and there was no way that I was going to be okay for any conceivable amount of time without a little bit of help. So I did. I was only in that part for about 15 days. They put me in normal population, and they started taking me to AA meetings, and that's where I met my now sponsor. I started going to these meetings, and by that time, you know, I don't know. Sobriety's funny for me. Like, for the first 15 to 30 days, I am just willing to do whatever it takes, but really quickly, I just get my ego comes back, man. My judgments come back. I start thinking, man, maybe I misjudged that. You know, maybe I overreacted a little bit on that last time, but you know, I got here and I started hearing some things, and started hearing some things that I really liked, and I started secretly reading this blue book right here, this big book, and started secretly praying, and you know, where nobody could see me, and I just knew this. I just knew that there was really no hope, and these guys that were coming to the meetings, I was pretty sure. So I was under investigation at the time, and I was pretty sure that these guys were detectives, and they were all there to just investigate me. But, you know, I was willing to overlook that part if what they said was actually true. So they said, "Let's do a fourth step." And I had some blaring things. You know, I stole a gun from my dad and took it downtown to sell it for this stuff. And I was going to sell the stuff, but I got back, and it was freaking salt. And so I sold my dad's gun for salt to a drug dealer, and that really bugged me a lot. And I had a whole bunch of other blaring things, and you know, I did the best I could with this fourth step. Didn't really understand how to do a fourth step, but I just basically told the bad stuff. And you know, shortly after I did this fourth and fifth step with my sponsor, well, let me kind of tell you how it went down. I went to him and I said, "Hey, I got this stuff written out. Will you do my fifth step?" He said, "Yeah, come on." I said, "Do you believe you're an alcoholic and you're powerless over alcohol?" I said, Yeah. You believe that a power greater than yourself can restore your sanity? I'm like, "Sure, yeah, whatever that means." And he said, "Okay, cool." And he takes out his hands and he gets on his knees. And I found that to be very questionable, very strange in jail with this stranger getting on my knees. But I did it. I get on my knees and we said the third step prayer. And I told him that. And I got some relief, man. I got some relief. I could sleep that night. Went back to my cell and I could sleep. And being sober in jail and being sober in prison is a strange thing because it's very, very boring in there. You get a lot of time to think. And I'm a thinker, man. I like to think. I like to think about me. I like to think about you. I like to think about what you're thinking about me. I like to think about a lot of things. And that's just what I was thinking about the entire time. And but, you know, I just made the decision. And let me tell you about these decisions that I make, that we make, I guess. I can make a decision all day long. But if it isn't followed by the correct amount of action, it ain't worth a dadgum, man. So I made a decision. I thought, at this time, I said, "Man, I got the willpower to do this, and I'm going to stay sober, and I'm going to stay sober even with this misery and this craziness and this uncomfortability and this irresistible urge to go and do something to relieve it. I'm going to stay sober throughout all that. That's the way sobriety is going to be, and I'm willing to do that, and I was willing to do that." And I think that's, you know, I didn't really understand that I could be relieved of this thing. So got in, got down to my place. They wanted to give me 10 years. I went in there, I cried to the judge, and I told the judge, "Hey, you know, I did the things that you think I did. I'm guilty. I want to make it right. Give me whatever sentence you think is appropriate, but can you make recovery a part of it? Because I need help. If you don't give me help, I'm going to come back before you day in and day out." This is my 22nd time in jail, and they knew that. I knew that. And they said, "Okay, I'll give you some help." There's several men in here that were actually a part of the group that came in there. So I thank you guys for that. When I got down there, I had a big book. They had a program, a prison program they sent me to. It was like 6 or 9 months. Went down there, got out, and I had a bicycle, and I had a room in a halfway house. I somehow got a spot in a halfway house. It's a place called Oxford House, and I thought I was living large, man. I didn't have a person in the world except for you guys, and I was working a program, and that I did the best I could for about 30 days. And then she showed up, and I saw her, man, and I'm telling you, dude, she was hot. And I told my sponsor, I said, "Sponsor, I'm getting laid." And he says, "Do whatever you want to do, just, you know, work the steps first." And he didn't really say that, but I did, man. You know, I knew I wasn't supposed to, and I knew it was kind of against the wishes of you guys, but I've never really been good at following instructions, and this doesn't have anything to do with drinking or using anyway, does it? It's a relationship, it's just a lady. So I got with her, and I felt good. And I said, "Man, if one girl's good, three would be great." So I had the girl from probation who was just amazing. I liked her a lot, man. She was sick, dude. She was addicted to heroin. I liked that. And I had the one girl from the gym that I was working at, and she was just nuts, and she was kind of like the backup. And I had another girl, and I just thought, "Hey, this is the solution, man. I found it. I can work the steps, and I can, you know, sleep with multiple women, and, you know, three threes make a 10, right?" And you know, I had these girlfriends, and you know, this is for a little while, and I'm going here. I remember this girl's uncle, and this is not, you know, I've got over a year sober at this point, man. I had been in jail for a year, so I'm sober for a year, right? And so, in my mind, and I just completely stalled on the steps. I'm not working the steps. I'm working these women, and I get to this one girl's house, and her uncle's over there, and I fall asleep in the next room with her. It's not her uncle. It's actually her boyfriend. He smashes my windows out. And so things like that are going on, but I don't see it coming, man. I have no idea it's coming. The guys at the halfway house are like, "Dude, you're about to get drunk, man." And I didn't see it coming. And I go over to one of the girls' house one day. I'm not liking the way I'm feeling. She's got some beer in the fridge. And I said, "I'm going to drink a beer. And I'm just going to go pick up a white chip tomorrow. I'm going to relieve the way I feel. And I feel this way. It's not because I'm an alcoholic. It's because the world's doing this to me." And suddenly the idea to drink came, and I was without defense against the first drink. And I drank, And suddenly everything changed. And that's when it happened. You guys have described alcoholism to me. You guys have described the allergy. I didn't really believe that I have it, but when I drank, I saw it happen. Everything switched. It didn't, going to work didn't matter. Going to this intensive probation didn't really matter. Nothing really mattered but drinking. So I drank, and like I said, I like to go up. So I went and got up too that same night. I went and tried to get a little bit, ended up getting a whole lot, and I'm off to the races. A couple of the guys tried to come and 12-step me, and just one of the guys just ended up doing the rest of my sack with me. And that's just the way it works, right? And so the run, that was my last run, and that run lasted for about 2 weeks. And I had gotten out of two drug tests from probation, and the third one they said, if you don't come in here and test, we're going to lock you up anyway. And so I got some fake piss, did my thing. I know how to pass a drug test. I'm smart. I'm not stupid. I'm not going to go up there dirty and just let them get me. I got up there with the fake piss, and he said, look at you, man. You're on it. And I'm like, okay, yeah, you're right. I'm on it. Whatever. Okay, what are you going to do to me? He's like, we're not going to lock you up. We're not going to do anything. But here's the problem. Here's the issue, right? I couldn't not have it, and I couldn't leave it somewhere. This was my precious, man. I'm like a schmeagle with this stuff. When I get this stuff, I'm like, man, my precious. So I had it with me in the car at probation taking a drug test. They went out and searched my car, and here I go. So a relapse and a white chip turned into a two-year bid. So they sent me down. I got back in front of that judge really quick, and he said, 2 years, man, you're going back down the road. Went to prison, and this time I went to prison sober. And this is that was the last time. That was September 5th. 2016. I did the best that I possibly could while I was in prison, man. I got, this is actually the big book that went in with me. I was able to get one of these when I went in. It was able to go through prison with me, and this is what I worked the steps out of now. I still got some of the notes, some of the misunderstandings or maybe understandings at the time. So I keep this book. I still got the same 12 and 12. I still got the cigarette papers where I used to mark my pages in prison. And you know, I stayed sober in prison, man. I said, okay, I'm gonna stay sober no matter what. I'm gonna do this thing. I really understand it now. So I get down there, and prison's a strange place, man. It's one minute, like for weeks and weeks, it's like nothing, and then all of a sudden it's freaking chaos, and then it's nothing again for a little while, and it's chaos. But you know, I had both of these times. I ended up writing you guys. I wrote my sponsor. I had a couple of people in the program that would write me, and one of them was mainly my sponsor today, and he would write me once a week, and he had a little bit of money on the phone, and I was able to stay connected with you guys for the 2 years that I was in prison. You guys saved my life there, man. You gave me sanity. And so I had a dog in prison. We had a yard. I had a dog, and we would go out to the yard, and I always find somebody that would was willing to read the big book with me. We'd go out and read the big book, and you know, I just had this hope. I was like, this is what I want, this is what I need, and this is how we're gonna do it. And we didn't really know what we were reading, but we were reading it together. And everybody else might have been going crazy and getting on stuff, because there's a lot of stuff in prison that I just love dearly. A lot of my favorite things are in there, and they're very abundant. But I didn't get to do it, and I didn't do it, and I just sacrificed that. And I said, you know, I'm going to stay sober no matter what from this point on. And I was getting out. I was on my way to getting out, and my sponsor sends me this letter for the Rock. And that letter for the Rock, he says, fill this application out. If you make it by the 10th, October 10th, and you come to this thing. And one Monday they said, hey, Nick, you're getting out. Do you have a ride? And I was like, no. Can you find one? And I was like, maybe. I'll try. And I ended up finding a ride back to my town and came down here a week later out of prison, crazy. It was not a bad experience, but it was not the best experience either. And I was just a little bit like frayed around the edges when I came down here. And I was really trying to work the steps, but this one thing kept coming up, the thing I told you guys about. And I wasn't going to tell anybody about this. And I told somebody, and I got free. So I found freedom here. And this whole time, I was here for one thing. I was here for relief. That's all I've ever wanted was relief. I didn't know freedom existed, because all I've ever had is what I am. And that's all I ever knew. And you guys gave me freedom. And that's the first time I experienced freedom from bondage, freedom from self. And I was able to really open up. And I was really able to connect with you guys. And that's the first time I did that. Now, working the steps, I wasn't really able to do the steps before that because that one thing kept coming up. But a first step, I mean, yeah, powerless over alcohol, my life is unmanageable. Powerless over alcohol, yeah, but my life is unmanageable because of me. My life is unmanageable when I manage it. That's the main thing. Restoration to sanity, I'm still not sure if that's happened yet, but you know, maybe we're there. But you know, a power greater than myself is the one that's going to do it, and I think that he does it incrementally. And then, you know, the third step prayer is essential, but the action. It's the action of actually writing it out. So I started getting to work, man. I started writing, and I started writing a four-step, and I started writing the five columns, and I started doing exactly the way I was told how to do it, which is the first time in my life. And I did a fifth step, and we didn't get all the fifth step done in the same session, but this is the first time everybody I had ever told anybody the whole story. And I went to my sponsor's house, and we went over there, and we went on our session, and we would do the fifth step, and I started getting freer and freer and freer, and finally we finished it up. And I remember there's this guy named Todd, man, and I was stalling on my fifth step, and I went to Todd. He just happened to be one of my meetings, and I said, "Todd, stalling on my fifth step." And he said, "Man," he said, he was a little rough with me. He said, "Man, if you don't finish your fifth step in 2 weeks, you owe me $200, and I'm coming to get my money." He just talked to me like that. Todd's here right now. And I said, all right, Todd, I know you're coming for your money. I finished my fifth step, right? I finished the resentments. I got all my resentments done. Yeah, I finished the fifth step. He's like, "Hey, what about the other four? Or the other three?" I didn't know there were three others. I conveniently skipped over that part, but you know, I did. I did the sex. I did the fears to the best of my ability. I wrote this thing out to the best of my ability. I did not know how to do a four-step, and I'm better at today than I was then. And each time I do one, I'm better at it. But I did it to the best of my ability, and the point is to do it, and I did it, and that's where the freedom came from. I did that, and then my sponsor beat me up a little bit because after all these things, he started throwing out these words I'd never heard before, and they call them defects of character. Gotcha. They call them defects of character, and there's a lot of them, man. There's a lot of them. I think he gets them from the Al-Anons. Those guys are really big in their feelings. And so we started, you know, uncovering these defects of character. And he said, "That's what this is. These are your variations of self. This is who you've become in order to, these are the tools that you've applied to these situations. But let me tell you who you actually are." He said, "I want you to go look at the antonym." And he said, "This is the opposite of the defect of character. This is who you actually are. This is who we're going to pray that God brings out of you." So I started dropping things. I started dropping the fifth step. I started dropping the defects. I started using this process as a process of deletion, man. And I started deleting the things that I added to myself. And we do not, this is one thing I know about God's universe. I don't know a lot, but I do know this. We do not exist in a vacuum. There's no such thing. So when I take away the defects, something else is going to move in. And the more of me I take away, the more God moves in. That's how this works for me. So the more of me I can take away and the more of me I can get out of the way, the more of God is going to have access to me, myself, and the less of you that are going to get hurt. It's plain and simple, and I started to see this take place in my life. I started taking away these things and my judgments, my anger, my resentments, my all the defects that I have, and I started getting better. I actually showed up to work, and I showed up to work on time, and I stayed for my entire shift, and I went home, and I didn't steal from my boss. Amazing, right? I did that consistently over a year, and then 2 years, and then I got offered a better job, and I started working a better job, and then here I am working this job, and you know, my boss comes to me and he says, "Hey, man, you're we just got served, and this is my first financial amendment." And I go and I try to find a way out. I try to weasel my way out. But I owed some money. I owed some money to some debt collectors, and these guys were coming after me, and they were gonna garnish my wages. And I had just enough money to pay the debt collectors, and I didn't want to pay them that money because I had just started saving. I had just started doing well, but all the money I've been saving was gonna go to these debt collectors. But my sponsor said, "Ah, wreckage from the past. You gotta pay them, and it's their money." I'm like, "Okay, fine." So I did. I went, I got the money orders that they wanted. I went down there. I said, "Hey, I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is your money. I want to give it to you. Is there anything else that I can do?" She said, "Nope, that's great. Thank you." I walked out of there freer than I'd ever felt. Before that, I was saving money out of my fear of financial insecurity. After that, I had no fear of financial insecurity. I no longer feared. And I watched that money go back into my bank account effortlessly. And I started to realize what money actually is and who that money actually belongs to. And I started to see the world in a whole different place. About a few years in, man, I'm working a great job with one of my best friends. We're out there. We're doing some door-to-door sales, man. We're out there hustling. We're doing some things. And we get a text message, and somebody says, "Hey, I got this person that wants to buy the product that you'll have. Can y'all give her? And I recognized the name. And the name was my mom's best friend when she was in recovery. This lady named Linda. And I said, this is mine. This is weird. And so Linda reaches out, and I said, yeah. And I got in touch with her. She's like, oh my God, I thought you were dead. And we had this great conversation. I'm not dead. That was pretty much like I hadn't had a conversation. I thought you were dead. And at least 3 years. I'm about sober 4 years now. And she says, oh, I thought you were dead. I'm like, no, I wasn't dead. I didn't know where you were. And I was like, but yeah. So how do you have anything for my mom? And she's like, I don't know. Actually, let's talk. And so she invited us over. She invited my whole family over. She said, let's talk. And I said, okay, cool. And she had this video of my mother. My mother made a video before she died. And it was a movie. She somehow knew that I wasn't going to see her, and it was for some time later. I don't know what inspired her to make this movie, but for some reason, I don't know what inspired her to keep this thinking I was dead all these years, but she did for some reason. And so we came over, and I had, I had so much hate and so much resentment and so much just nasty stuff in the bottom, just depths of me for her, my mother. I just didn't like it. And it's kind of hard to hate a dead person. And that started to come up, man. I started to bubble up in recovery, and I didn't really know what to do. And we went over there, and I talked to her. She handed me this tape, and I took it home, and I looked at it, but I couldn't bring myself to watch it. I don't know why. There was just something blocking me. There was that thing that was blocking me, and it was a very turmoil, man. I was actually arguing with my wife a lot. I was doing things. I'm married in recovery, so I'm married to an alcoholic, so it's easy to fight with. We enjoy that. I couldn't watch it. I couldn't bring myself to watch it. I came down here. I came down to the rock, and COVID had happened, and I'd missed a few rocks, but this is the next rock, and I came down here, and I was able to sit out there in that field over there, and just all this stuff came up, and I got to say what I wanted to say, feel what I wanted to feel, cry the way I needed to cry. The only way I can visualize it is like this black muck just coming out of my soul and just clumping out, and I got rid of it. I got rid of it, man. And I don't think anything could change that experience. I got rid of all of the stuff that I had, and I got to go back, and they threw a party the next week coming back from that particular rock. That was the last one ago. I can't remember which one. But they threw a party, and it was all these people that my mom was in recovery with. She got sober at a place called Easy 123, and she had all these people that knew her and were still sober to this day, women that she had sponsored, and I get to rewrite my entire past. I get to see a whole new person of who she is. Thanks to Alcoholics Anonymous and people staying sober. These are people with 20, 30 years all coming to get together and talk about this woman, this beautiful, awesome, amazing soul that was my mother, who I saw completely different. And I got to fall in love with my mother. And I got to meet my mother for the first time. And I went home and I spoke to her. And I didn't speak to her. I spoke to God, and I watched the video, and she spoke to me, man. And she talked to me, and she told me about God, and she told me about her life, and she told me about dying, and she told me about her fears, and she told me how much she loved me. And you know, she just told me those things. I got to 20 years after she passed, 7 years into 6 years into sobriety, I got to meet my mother for the first time almost ever. And I think that's an amazing story, and I'm so grateful for this place for having done that. Now, there's another experience I had when I said I'm married. That was fun getting married in sobriety. That was interesting. I think that I kind of lied a little bit at first because I used my actual sobriety a lot more than my actual work, and she wanted to make sure I worked the steps. So, you know, I decided I'm not going to, when I got out of prison this last time, I decided, well, I'm not going to use any more people. I'm especially not going to use our women. But I got to do something. I saw her, and I just thought, you know, she was off wandering around in the woods in a party, and I heard her sing one day. She could sing, and I just kind of fell in love, man. I said, I'm going after her. I'm going after this one. And the problem is with me is I'm discontent. So
I buy a truck. I got a red truck out there. It only took a month after I bought that truck for it to be the wrong color. I'm just like that. So I had to combat those things. But my sponsor always said this. He said, you make her the one, and you treat her as if the possibility of kids and families in the future, and you'll be just fine. And he kind of coached me through that. And this man rebuilt me from the ground up. And he taught me how to treat women. He taught me how to treat myself. He taught me how to be in a relationship. And he's teaching me how to be married and a father at this point now. And I, you know, it's been a year. She started dating me in the halfway house. A couple years later, we were married, and then we had a kid on the way, and this kid started having some issues, and we didn't know what the issues were, but she stopped growing in the womb, and here we are in the hospital, and everything's fine. And the hospital says, oh, nope, we got to go. Heart rate drop, emergency cesarean. I'm running to the hospital. I'm like, dad on fire. I'm going down, and you know, I come running in. I take the thing I'm supposed to put on my head, or my shoe on my head. I've got that on my head. I'm just a mess, man. I have no idea how to put scrubs on, but they gave me scrubs all by myself. Just an unattended alcoholic in there was trying to put scrubs on, and you know, they were all laughing at me, and we get in there, and I remember this. I got in there, and they wheeled my wife in there. It was during COVID, so there's nobody else in the hospital. There's just nothing. Nobody. It's just desolate, and I'm supposed to be freaking out, and it's just peace comes over me. It's just peace. And I can't explain it. I just have peace. And I made a call, made another call, said the baby's coming, called my sponsor, and just sat down and prayed and said, all right, God, let's do this. Went in there, held my wife's hand while they took this baby out, heard her cry, and boom, I'm a dad. And I'm like, looking at this kid, and I'm looking at God, I'm looking around, I'm saying, you really going to trust me with this? Okay, you better help me, God. You better help me with this one. And that was just a... something I can't really describe and I can't really explain. And, you know, recovery isn't all like rainbow farts and unicorns, man. It's hard. It's a lot of work for me because I don't care how spiritual I am tonight. I guarantee you I'm going to wake up in the morning and there's going to be something a little bit off. And I'm going to be a little bit more irritated with you. I'm going to be a little bit more restless with other things. I'm not going to have quite enough money in the bank. I'm not, you know, things just aren't going to be quite right, you know, and you give me 1, 2, 3 days of focusing on my career or focusing on my family or really just focusing on Netflix. I don't know, whatever. Give me a few days of not focusing on my recovery, not putting it first, and that thing, that irritability, that alcoholism, this untreated will become more untreated and it'll take hold, and suddenly I think I need to treat the world with an internal condition. And I have an internal condition. It separates me from you. That's its first objective, to keep me away from you. Because if it can keep me away from you, then it can definitely convince me that taking a drink is a good idea. That taking a drug is a good idea. And that is really the whole plan. And that's really why the way I feel. And it's probably why I have so much attention to the way I feel. Because the way I feel is very important to me. And it's very important to most of the people I know. Man, I'll tell you this. Working these steps has transformed me into a man I never thought I could possibly be. It's caused a transformation in me. Working these steps and being around you guys has caused a rebirth. And now I have men. I have men just like me, scumbags. I just get the scumbags, man. And they find me. And we sit down and we read this big book together and I have no idea what I'm talking about. We read the big book, and I take them through these steps the same way I was taken through these steps. And sometimes I get a little bit of advice from others because I have no idea what to do with some of my guys. But you know, I think that God pulled me out of the muck. I think that I was given a brand new life so that I could use my experience to guide and walk hand in hand with somebody to give them exactly what I have right now, which is peace. I'm comfortable in sobriety right now. That is the only thing I ever wanted, was to be comfortable, period. And I'm comfortable in sobriety, and that's what I have. And this place here is a huge part of it. You guys are a huge part of it. I owe my life to you guys. I want to thank you for that. I love y'all. Let's have a fun Rock 80, y'all.